Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome Susan Quinn. She is the author of the book Furious Improvisation, How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Made High Art Out of Desperate Times. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
First of all, take us back to the origins of the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. What was it and why was it formed?
Well, the WPA grew out of one of the really most desperate times in our history, the Great Crash of 1929, and then the Depression that followed, and it truly was a terrible time. People were losing their jobs at the rate of 20,000 a day, and that went on for, 3 years after the crash, and people were out of work. They were losing their homes. They were going east and west, riding the rails, looking for jobs. So out of this terrible time came to the rescue Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal. He was elected in 1932 and acted very quickly for the first time with massive government programs to put people back to work. And one of them was the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. And it was the largest government program of any kind ever in the United States. And put about 8.5 million people to work doing all kinds of things. And there's all kinds of evidence of what they did around Santa Fe. But they built miles and miles of roads. They built bridges. They built parks. They built airports. And then the really remarkable thing, and this is what my book is about, is that the WPA also hired artists and put them back to work. The head of it, Harry Hopkins, said artists have to eat too, just like other people. And so they had these arts programs. They had a program for visual artists, painters, and one for writers, one for musicians, and then the one that I've written this book about, which was the program for theater people, for actors and theater people. It's called the Federal Theater Project.
So tell us about Hallie Flanagan. She was the director of the Federal Theater Project. She was, first of all, an extraordinarily independent woman for her time and actually for any time.
She was. It was very unusual for a woman to be in this kind of prominent position in 1935. She had grown up in Iowa and gone to Grinnell, and that was the connection she had to Harry Hopkins, who was head of WPA. So he knew of her from college days. But after college, she had really distinguished herself and become a really remarkable, innovative theater person. She was, she had a really tragic losses early in her life. Her husband died of tuberculosis, and then she lost a child soon after that to meningitis. So she was on her own and needed to find a way to make a living, and discovered her talent for theater direction, was one of the very first women to get a Guggenheim Fellowship and travel to Europe, where she imbibed the theater of Europe, and especially of Russia. This was in the 20s, when Russian theater was new and exciting and doing very interesting experimental things. And then out of that, she wound up after that going to become the director of theater at Vassar in an experimental program at Vassar College. And her things were so original that they got picked up and reviewed by the New York papers, the New York critics. She would do things like she would do a one-act play in three different styles, three different modern styles, for instance, and do the same play three different ways. She was really a very cutting-edge theater person. And then she got hired to do this huge job of running the Federal Theater Project. And a lot of people in the beginning thought, oh, she's too arty, she's too much of a university intellectual, she'll never be able to handle this, because the goal of the program was to hire professional theater people. A lot of them were vaudevillians, they were people who had been done road shows all their lives, real professionals. The question was, could she do it? But she turned out to be amazing and to do really original things.
Now, she started something called the Living Newspapers. Tell us about that.
It was an idea that came from Europe and from her travels. And in Europe, it had been used as in a kind of indoctrinating way to sort of put across the ideas of the left in Germany and in Russia by taking current events and presenting them in a sort of lively fashion on the stage. And the really smart thing about it in terms of the Federal Theater Project was that they had all these thousands of theater, out-of-work theater people to employ. And the question was, you know, if you just did straight plays, how are you going to? They had 12,000 people to get jobs for. If you just did straight theater, how are you going to employ all these people? So the Living Newspapers were a way of really using lots more people, because what they did was they took an issue like, for instance, slum housing. And they presented the history of it and all the problems around it and so on. And they used real newspaper documents. They documented it carefully. But then when they put it on the stage, they made it into really lively theater, using vaudevillians and using clowning and using all kinds of visual tricks. And they were very successful with this. They did lots of different issues. They did one on the plight of the farmers, and they did one on public versus private ownership of electricity. It was called Power, which sounds like it might be kind of a tedious subject. But these living newspapers were, in fact, living and very lively. A little bit, perhaps, like the Michael Moore movies about public issues like 911 or the health system, you know, presenting things in a very, very lively fashion.
It's interesting because you talk about how so many people were out of work in the theater as well as everything mm-hmm. else, and they needed to be employed. Did the Federal Theater Project actually make a significant dent in this unemployment situation?
Yeah, it really did. At its height, it employed about 12,000 actors and backstage people all around the country, and it did make a big difference in people's lives. But the other thing about it, at the same time, it was really, you know, a very small part of the overall WPA program and budget. It was like 0.1% went to the theater project. But first of all, it employed all these people. But second of all, because the tickets were really cheap, they're like 50 cents, lots and lots of people who'd never seen theater before got to see theater, and they did theater all over the country. So hundreds of thousands of people who've never seen live theater got to see it for the first time during the Federal Theater Project.
There's also the reality that, and it's sort of a poignant and slightly painful thing to read, that a lot of the people who were out of work were not of the highest caliber either, and mm-hmm. the directors had to make decisions about how to use some of these people who were maybe second-rate actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And older, a lot of older actors,
right.
Because what had happened, even before the Depression, a lot of the old-time the theaters were on the ropes. Vaudeville and road companies were suffering because of the movies. And so, you know, they were really already kind of outdated, a lot of them. So that was that part of the challenge. And there's a great story about this one old vaudevillian who used to work in burlesque, and he would tell dirty jokes, and then he would rope. He was a roper who, you know, used his lariat to do different tricks. So the question was, you know, you couldn't have him getting up and telling dirty jokes on the federal dime. So how would you use it, someone like this? So the Children's Theater Company used him. And what they did was they had him recite a nursery rhyme, and he would say, "One misty, moisty morning when cloudy was the weather," and then he would rope a little bit, and then he would say the rest. And, you know, he was only allowed to say the nursery rhyme. So this was just one example of the sort of inventive ways that the Federal Theater rechanneled the talents of some of these particularly older vaudevillians and road people. And there was another one, I think it was Faust. Yeah, it was the Faust. One of the people who was involved with the Federal Theater was Orson Welles, who really got his start in the Federal Theater. And in his Faust, there was a clown who had been a vaudevillian, and who was quite old, but he was a wonderful clown in this production, and he got great reviews, and it was the first time that he'd ever had a critic give him a review, because he'd, you know, never been in that kind of theater before.
We're talking to Susan Quinn about her book, Furious Improvisation. Now, there's a natural tension between federal funding and artistic freedom, and there's a natural mutual mistrust between artists and the government, even when the government is funding them. Tell us about the controversy around one of the early living newspaper projects, Ethiopia.
Well, to begin with, when Harry Hopkins, who was head of WPA, and Hallie Flanagan launched the Federal Theater Project, he promised that the Federal Theater Project was going to be free, adult, and uncensored. Those were his words. And they came back. They were quoted back at him a lot because the question of government control and censorship came up over and over again. The very first idea they had for a living newspaper was a living newspaper about Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, of Haile Selassie's Ethiopia, and this, which was happening just at that moment. And they prepared this script, and they were all ready to open when one person in the company sent a memo to the White House because they wanted to get the exact quotes of something from a Roosevelt speech. And the people in the White House, the press people, absolutely panicked because they thought it was very, very dangerous to directly quote the president and also very dangerous to get for the federal government to get into the middle of the whole issue of this invasion, because at that moment, even though public sympathies were by and large with Ethiopia against Mussolini's invasion, FDR was trying to stay neutral because there was a lot of opposition to any kind of involvement in war at that time because of World War I. And the country was very isolationist, and he needed the support of the isolationists in Congress to get his domestic programs across. So it was a classic situation in which the theater was faced with censorship. And at the last minute, actually, Eleanor Roosevelt tried to intervene several times, but at the last minute, they were unable to open this production. And I think about it now, it's kind of ironic, because the thing they were most concerned about was that public figures were going to be portrayed on the stage. You know, that Roosevelt was going to be portrayed on the stage and Mussolini was going to be portrayed on the stage. And I think now of, you know, Saturday Night Live and The Daily Show and whatever else, you know, it seems kind of it's no longer an issue. But it was an issue, and it was an issue especially because the federal government was funding the project.
And you know, then you have this weird situation where public figures and politicians, even Eleanor Roosevelt herself, try to get involved in making artistic decisions, which is just a disaster before it even happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as soon as they started to say, well, it would be all right if you had we could form a committee and we could look into this, and then you could have the public figures off stage, you know.
Right.
Which anyone who's ever been involved in theater knows that would just be deadly. So that whenever that happened, it was bad news.
So how was the Federal Theater Project implemented in places outside the big cities?
Well, this was a big challenge, and it was a big challenge particularly because it began to be an issue in the Midwest, especially because first of all, there was a lot of suspicion of the Federal Theater in the Midwest, and particularly the press were hostile. So it was in the beginning, there was a lot of censorship, direct and indirect, of productions in Chicago and elsewhere. But one of the things that kind of broke through was a production of a play called It Can't Happen Here. And It Can't Happen Here was about fascism coming to America, which in 1935 and 6 didn't seem all that outrageous an idea because, of course, Hitler was rising in Europe and Mussolini in Italy, and there was this Stalin in the Soviet Union. So there was dictatorship all around, and capitalism looked to be in disarray. And there were also these demagogues out there who, Father Coughlin and Huey Long, who were actually trying to, run against Roosevelt and take over. So it all seemed fairly plausible at the time. And then Sinclair Lewis wrote a novel called It Can't Happen Here. And Hallie Flanagan got the idea of turning it into a play, and not only turning it into a play, but producing it all around the country. And it wound up being produced and opened simultaneously in 26 different theaters all around the country. In Utah and Denver, they did a production of it in Spanish. In Miami, they did an all-black production of it in Seattle. So this is an example of the Federal Theater breaking out and outside the big cities.
You talked about how the audiences were not the same as they were for commercial theater because the tickets were so much cheaper. Then there were also some really interesting situations like the Civilian Conservation Corps project, whose audience was basically large groups of men around the age of 20.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the Civilian Conservation Corps was one of the great successes of the New Deal. And this is a program to hire out-of-work young men and take them out to the country to do planting and developing of parks and building roads and so on. And it left us with much of our national park system. There's lots of evidence of it around New Mexico, certainly, of what they did. It was a great idea, and these men earned $30 a week and sent 25 home to their families, and for many families it was a real godsend. It really saved them. So anyway, so the CCC was this terrific program for young men, and right from the beginning the idea was that the Federal Theater should try to go out and entertain these men in these CCC camps. But in the beginning, the programs weren't very successful. They weren't even very good. Then Hallie Flanagan got the idea that something should be written specifically for the CCC boys, as they were known. And the Federal Theater came up with something called the CCC Murder Mystery. And it was a very clever idea. What they did was they wrote this murder mystery, and then they secretly recruited CCC boys from the camp ahead of time to play different roles. Then they had some professional actors who also played roles. And so each production of this murder mystery was tailored to the boys in the camp, and there was a woman, a young woman who's very flirtatious, who's part of it, and who named all kinds of actual boys in the camp, and there was much hilarity about all of that, of course. And then they also were part of a jury, which had to judge whether the accused was guilty or innocent. So it involved them actively in this production, and it was a great success.
We're talking to Susan Quinn about the book Furious Improvisation, How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Made High Art Out of Desperate Times. You talked about Orson Welles, and we want to talk about him more, and John Houseman. Also, T.S. Eliot was involved, and his work was a great example of something that probably would never have been produced in a commercial theater context.
That's right. It was a play called Murder in the Cathedral, which has become a classic. And it's a play in verse, about Thomas A. Becket, so a historic play in verse. And a number of critics said about this, that Broadway would never produce this show because it would be commercially untenable. They couldn't make money on it. So the Federal Theater Project, because it was subsidized, was able sometimes to do really original work. And that was in large part thanks to Hallie Flanagan also, because she was one of those people who, wherever she went, made connections. And when she was touring Europe, she made a connection with T.S. Eliot. And he'd actually brought a theater piece to Vassar when she was there. So out of that grew this agreement to do Murder in the Cathedral, which was really the first critical success of the federal theater. It was the first time the critics said, this is more than just a charity operation. There's actually some serious quality theater going on here.
Now, tell us about the Voodoo Macbeth production. That was an Orson Welles project.
Right. That was the very first thing that Orson Welles did with this Negro unit. Now, one of the interesting things about the Federal Theater was that it was very committed right from the beginning to fostering black artists. And there were these, as they were called at the time, Negro units all around the country. And one of them was in Harlem. And John Houseman headed up that Negro unit in Harlem. And he got his buddy, Orson Welles, involved. And Welles very soon got the idea. They planned to do classics using all black actors. And Welles got the idea, we should do Macbeth. But we should set it in Haiti. And Macbeth should be like the black dictator Toussaint Louverture, who fought Napoleon and so on, who was a hero, but sort of a bloody hero. It's a fit. So they decided to set this in Haiti, and it came to be called Voodoo Macbeth because the witches were voodoo witches, and Wells played up the witch part a lot. Made it kind of almost the central part of the whole thing. And it was visually stunning with very striking costumes and sort of jungle settings. And it was a sensation. It opened at the Lafayette Theater in Harlem and played there for quite a while, got great critical reviews, and then moved down to Broadway, played there, and then toured the country. So, and it was the first all-black Shakespeare production probably ever. And the first of a number of really innovative and wonderful productions that Orson Welles and John Houseman did for the Federal Theater Project.
And it's so interesting that Orson Welles had been playing around with and sort of reshaping Shakespeare plays since he was an adolescent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was only 20, although he tried to make the Times think that he was, you know, older. He was very young. Very kind of impetuous and unpredictable. But he developed a rapport with these black actors, and they trusted him, wound up together creating something really remarkable.
Now, theater is, by its nature, very ephemeral. How much documentation survives, and how did you get a feel for these productions?
It is ephemeral, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to do the book, because you know, the visual arts last, and there's lots of evidence of that. I know around Santa Fe, there's really wonderful murals that you have in the museum there and the Capitol building and other places. But the theater, once it's gone, it's gone. But I was very fortunate in a number of ways. First of all, there are tremendous archives at the National Archives in Maryland. And then another source was that two people actually at George Mason University in Virginia discovered a cache of documents that were in an airport hangar outside of Washington, D.C., just neglected. No one was doing anything with them, and they rescued them. And they were these wonderful Federal Theater posters and documents of all kinds. And so those were rescued by these two researchers. And then the other thing they did, which I'm forever grateful, is that back in the 70s, they sought out and interviewed many, many people who had worked in the Federal Theater Project, and that for me was a godsend because those people have pretty much all since died. There's almost no one living who participated. Just a few people whom I talked to, but without these interviews, I would not have had that first-person material. And then also at Vassar, there were wonderful correspondence between Hallie Flanagan and her husband. She wrote to her husband almost daily back in Vassar. He was a classics professor at Vassar. And those accounts are wonderful and vivid.
So the book goes into detail on a number of these plays. We've talked about some of them. Some of the plays dealt with subjects like farm policy, union organizing, strikes, police brutality, racial issues. Was Hallie Flanagan and were the theater artists on purpose choosing the most political hot-button issues?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, her feeling was that theater, you know, to be worth its salt, as she has said, has to have a certain amount of dynamite in that salt. She felt that the Federal Theater Project's obligation was to address the issues of the day. And there was a progressive left bent, certainly, to the leadership. Well, there was, you know, to the New Deal in general. Certainly, you know, the FDR and Hopkins and so on, they were all pro-union. And they were, so to a large extent, her leadership was in sync with the national leadership. But then there would be times where there would be tension, especially when FDR was running for re-election, for instance, or when there was a huge controversial issue. You know, then suddenly, and this again, this issue of censorship, you know, comes up. Suddenly, the controversial nature of the Federal Theater Project's productions would become an issue. For instance, in 1937, there were more strikes. And there was more labor management strife than in any other year in our entire history. And right plop in the middle of 1937, when this was happening, a wonderful new musical called Cradle Will Rock was rehearsing, and that was Mark Blitzstein's musical. And it's been produced a number of times since, and it's quite a remarkable piece. It's somewhere between musical and opera, and it's kind of in the style of Bertolt Brecht. So anyway, that rehearsals were going on for that. Orson Welles was directing it, and
What was it about?
It was about organizing and about the CIO, and it was about labor versus management. And management was portrayed as the main character is called Mr., and he was this greedy, sort of evil corporate figure. And then there was, of course, Larry Foreman, who was the great hero, who was calling together all the steel workers from their various trades, you know, to come and march together and to triumph. So, you know, that's the kind of tone of the thing. And meanwhile, there were strikes going on. There was violent strikes. There was a police. There was really a police riot in Chicago right in the middle of all this, where 10 strikers were killed. And the Roosevelt administration was trying to keep a lid on. So that caused a conflict. And ultimately, Orson Welles and Houseman left the Federal Theater over that.
I mean, it's a question of art and government that comes up on a fairly regular basis. I mean, I remember in the 1980s when suddenly under Reagan, Republicans were attacking the National Endowment for the Arts, and it was happening back then. But I mean, the theater, even though, I mean, the purpose of theater is to critique government, is to critique society, and yet government doesn't want to acknowledge that.
Yeah. And especially, you know, what happens, of course, is that because it's so highly visible, and because it has a voice way out of proportion to its size, becomes a target, and that's what ultimately happened to the Federal Theater Project. When there was, you know, Roosevelt and the New Deal kind of really sailed along until about 1938, and then there was a backlash, and a conservative backlash, maybe brought on in part by some of Roosevelt's actions, including his attempt to pack the Supreme Court. So in 1938, suddenly things came to a screeching halt, and this reaction set in, and the very first target of this reaction was the Federal Theater Project. Perhaps not surprisingly, because they were doing these socially relevant critiques, and sometimes they were quoting verbatim from these Southern congressmen who publicly embarrassing them. So it's not surprising that the Federal Theater Project became a target.
We're talking to Susan Quinn. Her book is called Furious Improvisation. So, I mean, during the Depression, the failures of capitalism were obviously highlighted, and therefore the ground was fertile for people of communist leanings. And Hallie Flanagan had gone to Russia herself. Where did she stand, and where did the Federal Theater Project stand in terms of communism?
Well, communism, as you say, in the 30s looked a lot more attractive in the early 30s than it did later on. Capitalism seemed to be on the ropes. Communism was new. It looked like it might have the answers, and many intellectuals in the early 30s were attracted to communism, including Hallie Flanagan. When she went to Russia, she was very taken with some of the new theater, some of the new avant-garde theater of people like Meyerhold, and it was exciting and interesting in those early days. I'm quite sure she was never a communist herself, but she was attracted to some of those ideas. Some of the other people who were in positions of influence in the Federal Theater were communists. Joe Losey, for instance, who did a couple of Living newspapers before he actually was fired by Hallie Flanagan for being too doctrinaire. But there were communists, particularly in New York. Once you got outside of New York, I think that there were very few. And out of the 12,000 employees, there were very few. But in 1939, this Southern Congressman, Texas Congressman named Martin Dies, set up the House Un-American Activities Committee, and with the idea, supposedly, of looking for un-American activities on the left and the right. He focused and tried to paint the Federal Theater Project as being infested with communists and run by communists. That was partly, you know, it was a very unfair claim based on a lot of testimony from individuals who had an axe to grind and who were one way or another tainted, sort of witnesses who were unreliable witnesses. So Hallie found herself having to defend the Federal Theater Project from a lot of false charges.
And that was, the Federal Theater Project was really the first of many victims of what was ultimately this horrible red baiting that went on for many years.
Yeah, and it set to Martin Dies and Huex starting in 1939 set that pattern of red baiting and insisting on knowing whether or not if someone was a communist and using a lot of very flimsy evidence and guilt by association to make accusations. And it's true, and then it became a pattern for Huac for many years, and was used also in the McCarthy hearings to taint a lot of creative people.
And when people, I mean, we've seen this in surviving film footage from the McCarthy era, mm-hmm. but you have in some of the you've reproduced some of this conversation with Hallie Flanagan. Testifying in front of Congress, and for example, she is asked to certify that people are not communists, and yet she's not allowed by law to ask people their political affiliation. And those kinds of contradictions are rampant.
Yeah, and it's a terrible bind because she can't say whether or not, and yet when she says she doesn't know, that makes her look guilty. And it's very difficult, although she does do a really good job of defending herself. It's hard to defend yourself against those kind of, against innuendo.
Tell us about the efforts to undermine the Federal Theater Project on the part of the right-wing press.
The Hearst Press, which is very powerful and was a chain all over the country, became very anti-New Deal. And particularly targeted the Federal Theater Project as being the worst part of the New Deal, and they over and over accused it of being a boondoggle, of being communist, of being a waste of taxpayers' money, and so on and so on. And at one point, they Hallie Flanagan actually hired a secretary who turned out to be working secretly for the Hearst Press and providing them with information under the table about the Federal Theater Project, and it finally came to light, and she was fired. But they were unscrupulous in their and determined in their attempts to discredit the Federal Theater Project.
There was also a commercial play called "I'd Rather Be Right." Tell us about that.
Yeah. It was actually it was Georges Kaufman, who was a wonderful comic playwright of the period, and he wrote this play called "I'd Rather Be Right," and the main character was FDR himself, and that was played by George M. Cohan, who was of course the song and dance man, and I have a wonderful picture of the book in the book of George M. Cohan looking like FDR. The plot of the play was incredibly simple. It was that FDR is walking around in Central Park, and he runs into a young couple who want to get married, but they can't get married until FDR balances the budget. So FDR says, well, I'm going to balance the budget. And then all kinds of different acts occur as a result of his promise to balance the budget. And at one point, he says to McIntyre, his associate, he says, McIntyre, get me the Wagner Act. I want to look at the Wagner Act. And the Wagner Act was an act which allowed unions to organize, very important act in the history of the labor movement. Anyway, so he says, get me the Wagner Act. And these two German weightlifters come out and start doing their weightlifting. And FDR says, McIntyre, have you gone mad? I wanted the Wagner Act. And McIntyre says, well, this is the Wagner Act, Federal Theater Project number 23406. And so this play has two or three references to the Federal Theater Project, making fun of it and making fun of the fact that it's omnipresent. Wherever you go, there's some Federal Theater company doing their thing, it's actually a very charming and amusing.
But, and the thing is, I mean, one of the things that was ironic about it was that by the time that play came out, which on the one hand was charming and amusing, but it was also kind of an attack on the Federal Theater Project, the funds for it had already been cut back so much that it really wasn't as ubiquitous as they claimed it was.
That's true. And in fact, the whole issue of balancing the budget was Roosevelt had this idea kind of after he was reelected that he was going to balance the budget. This kind of went back to his old sort of Dutch ancestry of being sensible about money and needs to balance the budget. And so to balance the budget, really large cuts were made in a lot of the New Deal programs. And the result of that was that Federal Theater was cut back drastically, but so were lots and lots of other programs in the New Deal programs. And a sort of second recession, a depression occurred, which is sometimes called the Roosevelt Depression, as a result of these drastic cuts. And this was one of the things that led to, eventually, to the backlash, because it had the effect of causing more pain.
We're talking to author Susan Quinn. The book is called Furious Improvisation, How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Made High Art Out of Desperate Times. Now, the powers that be and that knocked down the Federal Theater Project were dealing with the issue of communism in a very overt way. But just as threatening, according to your book, was the issue of race. Mm-hmm. Hallie Flanagan had from the beginning promoted racial equality and cooperation. Mm-hmm. How was this a perceived threat at that time?
Well, it was very unusual. The policy of the Federal Theater Project was that audiences had to be integrated. And it actually happened in Cincinnati, for instance, that when one company got to Cincinnati, they insisted on integrated audiences. The owner refused to allow blacks to come down from the balcony and sit in the orchestra with the whites. So they canceled their performance there. So it was a very strict policy of insisting on integrated audiences. And there was also these highly visible Negro units who were doing really interesting work and getting a lot of attention. And then there were also some productions which were integrated, blacks and whites, And this, believe it or not, was truly controversial and shocking, particularly to Southern segregationists. And in the testimony and in the hearings that occurred before HUAC and then before other congressional committees following HUAC's, the focus returned again and again to race. There was one witness in particular, her name was Sally Starnes, or her name was Sally, I can't remember her last name. Anyway, she was asked to come back several times to testify about the fact that she was a white woman and she had been asked out at a federal theater production. She'd been asked out by a black man. And when she went to the leadership of that federal theater production, the person said, well, he's entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness just like you are. This was her report, and this in itself was considered shocking by the Southern congressman. The fact that this happened, that it was condoned on the federal theater project. And there was also a lot of questioning about a couple of the plays, several of which addressed issues of race. So it's very clear to me that although communism was the purported reason for going after the Federal Theater Project, what concerned the congressmen and angered them even more than communism was this race mixing. And that, as I say, comes out very prominently in all of the testimony.
And that's just, I mean, basically Civil War legacy that never died.
Yeah. Yeah, these Southern congressmen, you know, Martin Dye's father had also been in Congress coming from Texas and had said, you know, white supremacy forever. And Martin Dye said the same thing when he was campaigning in the South. And the issues that were coming up also all right around this time, a lot of them had to do with issues of race. For instance, there was an anti-lynching bill, which became a very, very hot-button issue and which caused a long filibuster by the Southern congressman. And actually, this anti-lynching bill was not passed because a Southern congressman managed to filibuster against it. So there was a very strong resistance to racial equality.
And what's amazing is that we still have that problem today. We interviewed somebody on this show not too long ago who had made a bunch of documentaries for the ACLU, and the theme of racism, whether it be in voting or in policing or in the war on drugs, it always boils down to racism. It just it just won't die in this country.
Mm-hmm. It's a very, very deep-seated issue. It comes up over and over again. I found that with this book.
There's also the question of whether or not the government wants an educated, thinking populace, and you address that a bit in your book as well.
Mm-hmm. Living newspapers were an attempt, pretty successful attempt, I think, to educate people. And Hallie Flanagan's belief, and she says this, is that really what scared the congressman more than anything else was the fact that the federal theater productions were encouraging people to think about the vital issues of the day, to think about housing, to think about power, to think about agriculture and issues, labor issues, union issues. And the congressmen, many of them found this very threatening and found it alarming that it was being done with federal funds.
When you look at this, I mean, you're writing this book many decades after the fact. What do you see as the legacy of the Federal Theater Project to contemporary theater and to the arts in the United States today?
I think that the living newspapers, the legacy of the living newspapers, has been carried on in the documentary film and documentary television. Some of those ideas of using carefully documented backgrounds to present the facts, and Also, another legacy of the Federal Theater Project was that it did make some progress in the area of race, because particularly when it came to theatrical workers, until the Federal Theater Project, there were no blacks in any of the theatrical unions. And as a result of the Federal Theater Project, people who had worked in Harlem and some of the Negro units wound up becoming members of the theatrical unions. Certainly, it fostered wonderful talents, not just Orson Welles, but a whole host of people who got their start in the Federal Theater Project. People like U.B. Blake, musicians like U.B. Blake, actors like E.G. Marshall, Burt Lancaster, Joseph Cotton, Howard Da Silva, a black actor named Canada Lee, who went on to success in Hollywood, Arlene Francis, Paula Lawrence, and then there were musicians who got their starts, like Mark Blitzstein of Cradle of Rock, and the composer Virgil Thompson, writers like Richard Wright, Langston Hughes. All of them found a temporary home in the Federal Theater, which allowed them often to get a start and then to carry on with careers. So certainly that's part of the legacy.
And that's an incredible list.
Yes.
I mean, the other thing I was wondering about was, we at this point assume that there should be public funding for the arts. Is that also a legacy of this era?
Yes, perhaps, although the public funding for the arts is awfully small, relatively speaking, compared to what it was during this period.
Right.
And I think there's a whole question of whether how much federal funding we want for the arts. I was listening the other day to public radio. They were raising funds, and they were saying, well, it's a good thing that public radio is supported by private individuals and not by the federal government, because we wouldn't want that kind of control. It's just interesting, because I've always felt that the federal government should be certainly funding more of public radio and of other public arts than it does now. You know, and I look at the model of the BBC, for instance, which, of course, is entirely funded by the government, but seems to be pretty independent. And also, you look at the theaters of Europe, which have huge amounts of funding from government, but seem to be able to do some really cutting-edge theater, nonetheless. So I think it's an open question. It is true. It certainly... during the Federal Theater Project, the issue of censorship came up over and over again. And I'm not sure that our Congress could allow the arts, could leave them alone, you know, and not use them as some kind of weapons in the ideological war. And I think that's always going to be an issue in this country.
Well, it's a very interesting set of topics brought up by your wonderful, readable book. I was hoping there'd be even more illustrations, but there's wonderful photographs of some of these projects as well.
Yeah. I wanted to mention that I have a website. It's called furiousimprovisation.com, and there's more about the book there, so people can check that out.
Excellent. Susan Quinn is the author of the book Furious Improvisation, How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Made High Art Out of Desperate Times. Thank you so much for being with us this full hour on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's been my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow.